I wanted to talk about Land of Idols. Actually, I wanted to talk about books in general and my own development. Since I've turned 60, I can do that now, right? I can get sort of a little autobiographical, right, and say this and the other thing. And not only about books, but book titles, because this title was with me for years. For years, I had the title before I had the book. I had a title, Land of Idols. And when I did the book on the media, I said, maybe I'll make that. I didn't know. We decided Inventing Reality would be the title of that. And then I thought Make-Believe Media on the entertainment industry. No, that was Make-Believe Media. And I was doing the book on foreign policy. I said, I'll call this Land of Idols. But no, that wasn't really right. I called it Sword and the Dollar. So finally, I just had to invent a book to fit this title because I just liked the title, Land of Idols. I read it in the Bible, in Isaiah. It leaped up at me, and I'll read the quote a little later. So thinking about books and titles, let me tell you, for instance, let me just go back. Now here's where I lean back a little. I was born and raised in an Italian working class family. There may actually be some of you here who have never heard me say that before, but I'm very proud of my ethnic proletarian background. The only reading material I had in my home was a tabloid rag called the New York Daily News. That was the only thing. Not that my folks were censorious, not that they prohibited, but that was the only thing that came down the pike. Occasionally, I'd go to my Uncle Anthony's house, and he had Life magazine. That was a big treat. And I would hungrily pick that up and read it. So I never read. I just went for years. I didn't read. I was a street gang kid. I used to hang out in the streets. We used to climb fences and get into rock fights and steal fruit off the push carts and run down. And I mean, New York was a place in those days. It was worth living in. But we didn't read. You say, well, what about school? Didn't you read in school? No, you didn't read in school. School, you don't read in school, at least not in those days. There were more important things. You never really could have a block of time where you could just sit for an hour or 2 hours and just read, because there were always these other things you had to do in school, like wash the blackboards or do recitation lessons or line up for assembly, or there was always other things. I remember once in grade school, in Grace A. Meyer's class, going in the back and finding an old box of books. There were these children's biographies, and pulling them out, crappy little biographies on Teddy Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln. But hungrily, I started reading them. She said, what are you doing there? You know? I said, I'm sorry, Miss Myers. Now I would say, I'm reading, you fool. What do you think I'm doing? Isn't that the purpose of education? But I didn't say that. I said, I'm sorry. And I came and I sat down. I mean, she caught this kid reading on his own, which is even, who knows what that could lead to. So I went along like that. And then I and my friend Tommy Ferraro, who now teaches sociology at the University of Pittsburgh, he should be retiring soon, I think, but we started, when we were about 15, we discovered novels. We started reading, and I started like a hungry kid who had been held off from this stuff. I started reading. I would read every night. I would throw water on my face. I'd hide the blanket over the light so my folks wouldn't say, aren't you asleep yet, and all that. And I would read. I would read Saturday. I would read Hemingway and Steinbeck and F. Scott Fitzgerald, The Great Gatsby, which I read twice. I still think it's the most perfect novel. And I read plays, Noel Coward, Eugene O'Neill, and who's the other one? Oscar Wilde. I loved Oscar Wilde. And here I was, this East Harlem kid, reading this stuff and just finding it very liberating. And then I discovered the 19th century, the century when they really knew how to write novels. I read Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Thackeray and Dickens. And the 19th century had the great novels, but the 20th century, especially in the 30s and 40s, had the great titles, you know. Tender is the Night by F. Scott Fitzgerald. I mean, for a kid to pick it up and read that book, and a boring book about expatriates sitting in some cafes in Europe, and then Hemingway's titles were marvelous. Farewell to Arms, For Whom the Bell Tolls, The Sun Also Rises. I remember that one. I mean, what the hell does that mean? I don't know, but the kicker in that title was the also, you know? The Sun Also Rises. Another boring book about expatriates sitting around in Paris. I was, what are these people doing? But some of those books were terrific, and this was a very exciting thing. Then when I got to college, I didn't go right to college. I couldn't afford to go to college. I had to go to work. for a few years. But eventually I went to night school, and then I went to college, daytime, and I really discovered something even more fascinating than fiction, for me anyway, was nonfiction. That is the world. There was no author who could make up the kinds of incredible horrors and struggles and everything else that go on in the real world, you know? History, economics, politics, philosophy, and then the world of ideas. And looking at all this, I read Adam Smith. I loved Plato. I got through him. Aristotle, better. John Locke, it was fascinating. Marx, Freud. I read John Stuart Mill's On Liberty, and I remember getting so excited by On Liberty, I couldn't eat. I just couldn't eat. I just read it. I mean, today I have some very real criticisms about that book, but then it was like bringing together something, you know? But I also made another discovery, which wasn't too good, that much of what I read in college was not that nourishing, that much of it was dull and empty and textbookish, and that was because it was textbooks. It was from textbooks. And I also began to suspect something unpleasant, that there were writers who were not interested in revealing or nurturing or edifying, but who were really serving interests other than those of the reader. You see, I like to think I write with the conviction that I am serving the interests of the reader, unless you're David Rockefeller or somebody like that. And even you, David, would have a deeper, warmer, richer life if you agreed with us. He's laughing too. When I think I also decided there were some books that were undesirable. For instance, when I was in the Highbridge Library, by then I was maybe 16, I picked up a book. I mean, this is a book we could all agree on. It was by Adolf Hitler called Mein Kampf. And I started reading it. And what struck me as I began reading it, that this was a discernible human being. He was telling some things that were, you know, his family and being down and out in Munich and the rough time. And I could understand that. I came from a down and out background. And I was reading this and this. Even, then I got into all these pages of spleen and bile and racial bigotry and hatred, anti-Semitism, the toxic anti-Semitic poison, page after page. I'm reading this thing, and I was really, I mean, it literally was having a physical effect on me. I mean, I was no great civil libertarian or anything. I had no great politics at the time. I'm just reading this thing, I'm sort of like, phew, I couldn't. And I had to close that book, I remember, and being very confused, because I always thought of books as very benign friends and nurturing things and good things. And here was a book, it had every resemblance of a book, and yet it was toxic, I thought. And it was a book that was not to be burned or censored or not even to go unread even. But certainly it should never go unchallenged. It should be thoroughly exposed. And little did I realize at that time that much of my later life was to be devoted to that task. Not refuting the Hitlers of this world, but those who make things easy for the Hitlers, who dance with the Hitlers, who disguise the Hitlers and say, we're defending democracy with these tanks, you know, who monopolize the mass communication universe and much of the academic world, too, I was to discover, because I went into academia. And I, you know, I remember seeing a movie, Serpico. Remember that movie about, Serpico he was an Italian kid from New York. He went into the police. And I went into academia, and we both were the stupidest kids there on the block. He went into the police thinking they had something to do with dedicating themselves to fighting crime, and I went into academia thinking that this had something to do with the search for iconoclastic truth to speak truth to power. And then I learned that really wasn't what it was about. By the time I got to graduate school, I discovered the other disillusioning thing about books and scholarship, that the intellectual and the academic and the communication universe, not all of it, but the mainstream standard, with the guys who got most of the tenure and control all the high ground in it, was inhabited by people who seemed, in many instances, again, not always, but seemed intent on making communication as difficult and labored as possible. I always thought the idea is to make it clear. They wrote in very dense, opaque, and muddied prose. I think the term is impenetrable, isn't that what we call it? So instead of, you know, I thought it another beautiful title, I forgot to mention Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey into Night. Oh, I love that title. Instead of that, they published articles that were Long Day's Journey into Night, you know, with titles like, quote, Conflict Resolution in the Decision-Making Nexus, colon, there's always a colon, The Emergence of Bipolar Modalities. Now, there are several reasons why this obfuscation is so well encrusted and institutionalized in academia. There are several. The first is what I would call paradigmatic overdevelopment. I got a laugh on that already. This is a pretty intelligent crowd. That's very good. And they said it's a good room to work, the back. Ah, you're a lovely crowd. You're lovely. It's a very interesting thing. When a new basic paradigm, a new system of thought emerges, often the generator of that system of thought, Thomas Kuhn makes this point in his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolution, writes in what is rather accessible language. I mean, you could read Darwin. You could read Newton if you knew physics. You could read Marx, most of Marx. Early parts of Capital are really hard. You could read Freud, you could read these guys, and they're creating a whole new universe of thought, and you can get what are the great contours of it. What then begins to happen is by the second and third and fourth generations is the people who work within that paradigm begin to develop and refine it more and more, develop, and they begin to stake out their little piece of turf in it, and get their super specialized vocabulary, and then redefine that one, so you get the structuralist, post-structuralist, deconstructuralist, post-deconstructuralist, you know, and they all get into these little things, you know. I mean, you read the basic stuff in Marx in the Manifesto or the German Ideology and all that, and now read some of the Marxists today who, I'm not like this Marx, I'm talking about the Marxists who write only for other Marxists, and it, reading this stuff and you say, and it's really about Doug Dowd said it. It's about how many angels can dance on the head of a surplus value. You know, it's like, what are these guys talking about? Well, read Adam Smith. He's wonderful. And read today the academic economists who are into this supermodel building, which they often admit has nothing to do with the real world or the real economy, and where the models and the concepts begin to get reified and generate their own forces, and you now argue this whole thing only within its own terms, you see. And I always feel any kind of theory, and theory is a very powerful, important thing. It's not just people say, oh, that's just a lot of theory. No, theory is a very important, it's the organizing concepts, it's the cohesiveness of the things that bring it together. But theory never has any meaning unless you can bring it back down to a referent, to an actual thing in the real world. So that's what begins to happen. In time, the concepts have no empirical referent, and they take on a life of their own. The discourse becomes self-referential and self-inflating and self-generating. I saw that with Freud. If you read Freud, he's very, very lucid, remarkable. Whether you agree with him or not, and I disagree with him with most of his core psychoanalytic stuff, especially his enormous capacity to ignore child abuse victimization as he was seeing it right there. Jeffrey Musayef-Maison has written very beautifully about this, and importantly. But anyway, you could read Freud and you could understand him, and then read the psychoanalytic journals of the late 1950s, which I did read, and you're reading this stuff and you're saying, wait a minute, this isn't what makes people tick. I mean, they got so into their inflated concepts that you can't get what it's all about. The same thing with sociology. You know, the early sociology, the first studies about primary groups of street gangs, for instance, there's a gem of a little classic, William Foote White, called The Street Corner Society. Even the title reflects the book. It was very empirical. It was like early anthropology almost. He was up in Boston and he looked at working class street gangs in Boston. By the 1970s, a study of street gangs would have a title like, quote, Net Theory and Accession Roles, colon, again, The Street Gang as a Multivariegated Problematic. And that's what you know. We all know what comes out of a colon, right? There it is. Oh, bad joke. Sorry. No, sorry. That wasn't good. Cut that from the tape later. Another reason for this this kind of obfuscation is what I would call the scientistic pretense, and also the profundity pretense. I'll lump the two of them. They're different, but they're sort of so related. I'll put them together. By making things sound dense and esoteric and inaccessible, you develop an elite vocabulary. You make them sound profound or scientific. The psychotherapy journals, again, or those psychoanalytic journals, instead of saying the patient had sexual desires for someone, you say the client cathected his affects onto libidinous objects. And you say, you want to run that by me again? Did I miss something there? Now, it's really not clear how the cause of science is advanced by such nomenclature. What is clear is that scientistic pretense, the idea that you have, you know, this kind of thing. But the profundity pretense and the scientistic pretense feed paradigmatic overdevelopment. I think they're sort of part of the causes for it. The third reason, and this one is not often mentioned, but I think the third reason for obfuscated prose and dense prose is also the social sciences are often the masters of evasion, and that serves a political motive. When dealing with very controversial subjects in academia, you run the danger of yourself becoming controversial. Now, academics love to be controversial if it's in these little paradigmatic squabbles. In political science, we have the traditionalist versus institutionalist versus the behavioralist, and all these guys just have all their little fights. They like that. But it's not very good if the controversy deals with and confronts and challenges powerful political economic interests and powerful components of the mainstream establishment culture, political culture. When you do that, then you sound odd. Then you lose appointments, you lose research grants, you lose promotions, you don't get jobs. So you learn to evade and you learn to mute. You don't say the ruling class, which you empirically define and show what that means by that. You don't even do all that. You say the ruling class becomes, quote, dominant policy proclivities. The horrible, brutal forces of imperialism, they're diluted into dependency or development theory or multinational involvement. Marx once said that the politics is involved with the furies of private interests. That's what politics is about, the furies of private interests. That we will take you people and put you in the stadium up against the wall and we will kill you. We will shoot you if you interfere with the pursuit of our interests. You see, people will kill other people. Kill them, murder them, other human beings, to advance their interests in this way. Well, that politics today is called a pluralistic interplay and process configuration. Now that kind of writing, by the way, that kind of writing has a value. It's the kind of stuff you might benefit from if you're an insomniac. What I'm trying to say, this has all been a disguised commercial, because what I'm trying to say is Land of Idols doesn't do any of those things, I like to think. So, in writing this book, I was rebelling against those kinds of titles, and I was looking for the epic, biblical, evocative title, you know, the kind of the political equivalent of the Hemingway or O'Neill titles, that sort of thing. So I called it Land of Idols, comma, Political Mythology in America. That's the subtitle, Political Mythology in America. It has no colon in it. Also, the content of the book is not social science as usually defined, but it deals with issues of society. Somerset Maugham wrote something once, there's another guy I used to like to read, Somerset Maugham, The Razor's Edge, and all of that. And he said that the goal of a writer should never be simplicity, but should always be clarity. And that's a very, very, very important distinction, because some people mistake clarity for simplicity. Well, you can't be so smart, I understand you. You know? Well, hey, what does that say about yourself? They mistaken clarity for simplicity, just as they mistaken ponderous, opaque, overloaded, incomprehensible writing for profundity, the colon writing. So, by the way, that kind of writing is not just in the social sciences. You read it in literary criticism and philosophy and everywhere you could read it. Let me give you what are the title page quotes from The Land of Idols. The first one is from Isaiah 2, 7, and 8. Their land is also full of silver and gold. Neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land is also full of horses, neither is there any end of their chariots. Their land is also full of idols. The second quote is from Alan Watts, The Wisdom of Insecurity. These idols are not just crude images, such as the mental picture of God as an old gentleman on a golden throne. They are our beliefs, our cherished preconceptions of the truth, which block the unreserved opening of mind and heart to reality. The third quote is by Karl Marx. The demand to abandon illusions about our condition is a demand to abandon the conditions which require illusion. And we see today how that kind of political idolatry controls our belief and image system, and it's operating right before us, right this very day. The President of the United States getting up and saying he had no choice against these extremist gunmen and thugs. Look, in Russia, if you let the communists take over, who knows what they'd do? They might suspend parliament, rip up the constitution, bring tanks in and bomb the place and hit it and start rounding up people. They might close newspapers. They might, they might do all this kind of stuff. So we have to make the world safe. But democracy has very little to do with it, as you know. It's really, I hope you know, it's really to stop any kind of anti-capitalist view or approach, or any kind of, even any kind of redistributive forces within a capitalist framework. That's what, any dollar more we have to give you, whether it's in pensions or in occupational safety or in unemployment insurance or food subsidies, or any dollar we have to give you or better wages, is one less dollar for us. And that's what it's all about. As I said today on the radio, don't believe me. Listen to what the President of the United States said just last week at the UN. He said the function of U.S. foreign policy is to propagate, quote, market-based democracies. So if you have a democracy which isn't sufficiently market-based, it's okay to overthrow it. It's got to be market-based, free market. Free market becomes their term for capitalism. That's what free market is. It's a raw form of capitalism too. And it's remarkable how you can do that. You can make a hero. You can take the guy who is destroying democracy because it's becoming troublesome for the implementation of free market capitalism, who's destroying democracy, and you make him the Democrat. You lie. You say this constitution was put in by Brezhnev or Stalin. Not true. This constitution, everybody elected in this constitution with amendments that came in 1989 under Mikhail Gorbachev. They were elected, this entire parliament was elected in 1990. Every single one of them was freely elected, and there were no communist appointed seats. That was one of the lies. But you see, when you control the whole image system, you control the background assumptions. That's what Watts meant. These idols that are already implanted in our minds, this mythology that's there. Alvin Gouldner made this point in a book called The Coming Crisis in Western Sociology, that the truth of something depends less on the argument or evidence within it and more on how it fits in with our background assumptions. And the function of the media, that gaggle of concubines known as the free and independent media, the function of that media is to bring forth that political background with the images stacked so as to give confirmation to things as they want it. So you talk about the other side is having gunmen. You see, they're gunmen. Hardliners. Now, what do you mean hardliners? The hardliner is Yeltsin. He is the one who's willing to destroy the Constitution, destroy the Parliament, murder these people, do this in order to get this free market line in. Those are the hardliners. The other side aren't hardline to any extent. They're actually sort of moderate. They're calling for mixed economy and maybe keeping nationalization. They don't want to see the collective commonwealth of the nation being stolen by the Fortune 500 for bargain prices. It's just getting ripped off. They want to stop some of that. If anything, the hardliners were the Yeltsin forces, and the moderates, the more flexibles, were the others. But we just keep getting this. Hardliners. Now, in fact, we're hearing communists. The communists and fascists were working together here, and this is what they were doing. So they control the official vocabulary. you see a mass murder and hundreds of people getting killed and not a word of criticism. Can you imagine if it was the left doing this killing and shooting? I mean, you'd hear brutal repression, brutal slaughter of innocent people defending the Constitution, a coup d'etat that has taken place, and so forth and so on. They say when you do these book party things, you could read portions of your book. I've resisted the temptation through. I remember passing Black Oak one night. Susan Sontag was here, and I had to go somewhere else. But as I was walking by, two people came out and said, "She read so much of her stuff." So I said, "Oh, that's something every author should keep that in mind." So here I am in Black Oak. I want you to leave here and say, "All he did was read just a little tantalizing bits, and I feel so frustrated. I can't get enough of it." Well, I'm going to tell you about Antonio Gramsci, the great Italian communist. When he was incarcerated in Mussolini's dungeon from 1928 to 1937 for the crime of thinking, I mean, what was Gramsci? Gramsci was a newspaper guy. He wrote these wonderful analyses about how political hegemony and culture relates to class struggle and all this stuff. And we still read his stuff. We're not a Mussolini while Mussolini's bones are rotting in the grave and we can spit on his grave. People are still reading Gramsci. So we know which one of them was the real immortal. Not the one who strut around and pronounced himself the immortal, but the guy who sat there and he wrote. And Gramsci was in Mussolini's dungeon for the crime of thinking and being concerned about the well-being of the people of his country. And that's why he went to prison. And that's why so many people from El Salvador to Guatemala to Indonesia to Zaire are in prison today. For thinking and being concerned about the welfare of their people. That's why people in prison here, Geronimo Pratt and Leonard Peltier and others, in prison because they're concerned about the welfare of their people. So Gramsci's in prison. And the only thing that keeps him alive is they allow him to have a few notebooks. And he writes in the notebooks with a pencil. His prison notebooks, which are published, which I presume Black Oak has copies of. They better. And if they don't, they will tomorrow. But he had to be very careful to eliminate words or phrases. He had to eliminate phrases like Marx and Marxist and capitalism and class. Those words would attract the attention of the fascist censors. The fascists knew why they were in power. They knew what their job was. It was to make the world safe from anybody who was critical of capitalism and corporate multinational corporate capitalism. To make the world safe for the haves against the have-nots. And if the fascists found those words in the books, the censor, they would take away his notebooks and his pencils and he would not be able to do any more writing. So he had to write those coded phrases. The fascists understood their job was to suppress class consciousness, anti-class consciousness, wherever it might appear. So I'll read this next paragraph. It goes as follows. Today, most of our intellectuals, journalists, and social commentators avoid the use of the word class as carefully as did Gramsci. Unlike him, they are not in prison. Okay, he's got some Gramsci books out there for those who will later hear this on radio. I think I'm going to have to start from the top again. No, unlike him, we're talking about the intellectual journalists of our day, they avoid the uses of the word class as carefully as did Gramsci. Unlike him, they are not in prison and there's no need for rulers to put them there. Throughout their schooling and professional training, they are censored by superiors and more generally by the monopoly culture in which they live. Soon they learn to censor themselves. And by soon, after all, become so automatic and ingrained that it's not experienced as any kind of censorship. They still occasionally use words like Marxism and Marxist, but it is usually in a dismissive, negative labeling way. They don't need a fascist censor breathing down their necks because they have a mainstream one implanted in their heads. These internalized forms of suppression are far more effective in preserving the dominant ideology than any state censor could hope to be. Gramsci knew he was being censored. Many of our intellectuals and pundits think they are as free as birds. And they are, as long as they fly around in the right circles. Well, I like to avoid the use of the label Marxist when people ask me, well, is that Marxist? I say, no, that's Parenti. I don't know what Marx said about U.S. media in the 1980s and 90s. I mean, I must admit, Marx really began to impress me years ago when I was getting radicalized. I hadn't yet, like any good intellectual with a PhD from Yale, I hadn't really read that much of him. I said I read him undergraduate, and it was the Manifesto and a couple other things. I found that exciting, but you know, then it went. All this other stuff closes in on you. But he began to impress me because I would say certain things. I would come to the conclusion that class was a very important factor, and not just class as a sociological category, but as an instrument of power and a relationship to wealth. And I would say that, and somebody would say, that's Marx, isn't it? I said, Marx, oh. And then during the anti-war demonstrations, you know, it really hit me. It hit me in the form of two police clubs busting my head open, covered with blood and all that. And I came out and I said, you know, the police are not a neutral social institution. And people would say, that's Marx, isn't it? And I began making this discovery about all different social institutions, the church, the media, the universities, that they were not only not neutral, but they were also linked to each other by a commonality of class interests. And people said, well, that's Marx, isn't it? So after a while, I started saying, hey, this guy Marx must really be something. I'm knocking myself out here. Every time I develop an analysis, they give him the credit for it. And he's been dead for 100 years. Yet I still reject the label Marxist when someone throws it at me, not because of any silly thing about I refuse to be labeled. I'll be more effective if I'm not labeled, and I'll reach wider audiences, and they won't know, and I can say all different things, you know. I reject the label only because the people who use the term do not mean the same thing as I do. When I hear them starting to talk about it, I hear about a cartoon. I hear a caricature. I said, who is that, Marx according to William Buckley? What Marx is that? What the hell are you talking about? It's really hard to determine what they mean, since most of them have no familiarity with it. When I was at California State University in Northridge, I was there one semester as a guest professor, and a student came in my first week there, and she said, I really enjoyed your book, Sword and the Dollar. We read it in my IR course. I really like it. Thanks. It was really great. I opened my eyes. Oh, this and that. She was really interested. And she came back a few other times, and she would talk to me, and she would keep making references to, well, the hard line, the hardcore, this is before all this, right? The hardcore Marxist, and the Marxist, well, the Marxist. I said, hey, wait a minute, what's this hardcore? What does that mean, hardcore Marxist? You will read my book, comrade, and you will agree with it. Did you ever see Dr. Zhivago? You ever see the movie? They have a scene where Lenin is talking to Trotsky, and he's saying, all the communists in the whole movie talk like this. Comrade. And they never smile, and they don't catch on to jokes. You make a joke, they don't know what it means. What does that mean, comrade? And Lenin turns to Trotsky and he says, Trotsky, we know what it all is about. It's about power, Trotsky, power. I said, oh, gosh. So I said to the student, I said, what do you mean Marxist? I said, you know, Sword and the Dollar is a Marxist analysis. And she said, it was? Like that, you see. So, if you read Land of Idols when you finish it, you want to say, that was? Is that what it? Oh. Now, Marxism is not about Eastern Europe. It's not about the collapse of siege socialism. It's not the collapse of socialism in history. In fact, we haven't seen the collapse of socialism in history, no more than the collapse of the Democratic Revolution in France after 1794-95 meant the end of democracy and republicanism in Europe or the Western world. Even after the Bourbon Restoration and the Orléans Restoration, and two empires. Even after all that, the people could not go back to the feudalism and the tyranny of Louis XIV, Louis XVI. They couldn't go back to emperors. They could not forget the cry of democracy in the French Revolution, liberté, égalité, fraternité. And Marxism is essentially a critique of capitalist society and imperialism. And these are still very much with us. By the way, there's a lot in the book that isn't even about Marxism. It's about political notions, and I think Peggy touched on a number of those things. There's a chapter in there on the victimization of women. There are several chapters on racism and the like. What I would invite the reader to do is not only to think systematically, but to think systemically. Is a big difference. We're always taught in school, you must think systematically, A to B to C. But think also systemically. You know, Frederick Douglass, in his very beautiful autobiography, My Bondage, My Freedom, which I think Black Oak has a copy of, too. Sit down. That title is important because there are three versions of his autobiographies out, and that's the most complete, and it's beautifully written. He talks about a slave master, and he talks about the cruelty and the inhumanity of this thing. I mean, he talks about it ferociously. I mean, he lived it, you know, he was a slave, and then he fled. And then he does a very interesting thing. He praises the slave master. He has some nice words to say about him. He says, still, this guy is a human being, and he has some qualities in there that were rather exceptional as a person. It's a remarkable thing for a slave to get up. And it's not because Douglass has so much love in his heart for everyone who's human and he just wants to be there. Douglass had hate in his heart. He hated it. He hated this thing, and it comes out in those pages, burning, burning, burning. And there'd be something wrong. There is something wrong with people who cannot hate that which is hateful and harmful to human beings. And to deny that and say, well, we mustn't, well, you don't want them to judge you, but why are you judging the Nazis so harshly? You know, that's what they were doing, their thing, or the Ku Klux Klan, or whatever. And still he makes these statements, and he says, you know, this guy would not be so bad if he were living in a society where where his impulses would have to be mediated by the normal restraints of society, his empowering impulses. His moods would not be so brittle. They would not be so peremptory. He would not be lashing out. He would not be where he is, the slave master. He could have been a decent man with some capabilities and social virtues if he had been in a decent system. So Douglass's interest is not in denouncing the slave master, it's denouncing the system that develops the slave master. It's denouncing, that's what a radical analysis is going to the core. Denouncing the system that develops and necessitates these kind of militaries and these tanks and these murderous forays all over the world against people who never asked anybody to come in here, as we just see it happening in Somalia now. They never asked you in. They were hungry. And they were demoralized because they've been facing generations of colonialism. They're in that situation because you have already been there several times over, plundering that country. They never asked you to come for, quote, help. You went in when you discovered oil in Somalia. It was an amazing exercise in sociology. He was doing good sociology. He was thinking systemically about what produces this thing. Now, the media teaches you not to think systemically. It teaches you to look at each thing as a little fragment thing. What's in today's news? What's yesterday's news? What's tomorrow's news? What is that? How does that feel about that? What about little scattered fragment bits here, none of which are related, unless they want to make certain kinds of relations, you know. They make certain kinds of links that serve their purpose, very rarely. Well, one of the persistent ideological teachings in the United States is that our society is notably free from ideological teachings. That ideology is something that's imported from alien lands. Ideology is something that the hardliners, the hardcore people do, you know. But we are pragmatic and open and variegated and all that sort of thing. We're, yeah, 14 channels there, you know. Likewise, myths are something that ancient or primitive peoples have, like ancient Greek mythologies, you know. and that sort of thing. It's true that many Americans have beliefs about patriotism, religion, the undeserving poor, the self-made rich. These are all things I deal with in the book. They reject as conspiracy theorists and Marxists people who see powerful interests running most of this country. They seem to think that, unlike the rest of us, the rich do not consciously attend to their own interests. And what I argue is that such beliefs are themselves myths and ideologies, and that our political culture is riddled with mythologies that serve conservative class interests and keep us from fully pursuing a democratic well-being. The most insidious forms of ideology, by the way, are those that aren't identified as ideology but are seen as the natural order of things. The most insidious forms of repression and control are those which are so insinuated into the fabric of society that they're not defined and seen as repression and control. Let me just read two people what they said about myths, and I'm going to end it now, because there's some. Branislav Malinowski, the anthropologist, writing about his beloved Melanesian islanders, he observed that a myth isn't an idle tale, but it's an ideological force. Myths of origin serve to legitimate property claims, distinctions in rank, and the dominance of a particular clan. It's interesting that in a South Sea society, he saw that same operation of myth, that the people who were the dominant clan legitimated it with all sorts of myths of origin and say, well, you know, we're descendant from the moon and you're descendant from the, whatever, the toad or the alligator, so you were down there and that's why this is the way it is, you know. And there's always a few people say, oh, sounds fair to me, okay. You know, there's always a few, but most don't. The other one is Sigmund Freud, who I say I'm no particular friend of, but Sigmund Freud, I always revisit, even people I don't agree with, I always read some stuff, and sometimes when they're great, they're good, even when I think they're wrong. I think Freud is right here. He wrote that every social order seeks to defend itself. Quote, its organization, its institutions, and its laws, and I would add its myths, are all directed to this end. They aim not only at establishing a certain distribution of property, but also at maintaining it. In fact, they must protect everything that contributes to the conquest of nature and the production of wealth. I think he wrote that in Civilization and Its Discontents, or maybe it was The Future of an Illusion. I don't have the citation here. But it's in there, but I don't have it in the notes. I should have read that quote and said, now who said that? Now someone would have said, now that's Marx, isn't that? That's Marx. There are a lot of people who don't realize they're doing Marx when they get close to reality. That's what happens. Let me end with just one. I will read just one, which is three more lines. In the struggle for social justice and democracy, we must traverse a land of idols. The idols have been fashioned by those who would have us worship at an altar of their own making. I believe such worship is not a suitable vocation for a democratic people. The goal of this book is to divest ourselves. Let me change that for the word. Our goal is to divest ourselves of the myths that limit our understanding of political reality and undermine democratic viability. The hope is that the reader comes away with a more critical perspective of the idols of political orthodoxy and a more determined commitment to the substance as well as the forms of democracy. So that's my last word to you. Thank you very much.